This is the podcast for JNS Spine. Welcome to a special podcast for the July 2014 issue of Journal of Neurosurgery Spine. I'm Natalie Pinchem. The July issue is made up of the guideline update for the performance of fusion procedures for degenerative diseases of the lumbar spine. In this podcast, Dr. Michael Kaiser of Columbia University, New York, speaks with Dr. Daniel Resnick of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They provide insight into the guideline development process and discuss the importance of practice guidelines in general, as well as specific features of the lumbar fusion guidelines and the current update.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Michael Kaiser. I'm an associate professor of neurological surgery at Columbia University in New York City. And I'm here today to talk to Dr. Daniel Resnick regarding the guideline update for the performance of fusion procedures for degenerative disease of the lumbar spine. Dr. Resnick is a professor of neurological surgery at the University of Wisconsin, and by all accounts has been one of the pioneers of evidence-based medicine in neurological spine surgery. I believe, Dan, to date you've been involved with numerous, if not all, the guideline efforts initiated by the AANS-CNS Joints Spine Section. He's a former chair of the AANS-CNS Joint Spine Section and is the current president of the Congress of Neurological Surgeons. In January 2003, a multidisciplinary panel of neurosurgical and orthopedic spine specialists was convened at the request of the leadership for the AANS-CNS Joint Spine Section to perform an evidence-based review of the literature with respect to lumbar fusion procedures for degenerative disease of the lumbar spine. Issues addressed through these guidelines included the assessment of outcome, diagnostic modalities for pre- and post-operative evaluation, recommendations for specific patient populations, such as patients with stenosis with or without spondylolisthesis, and finally, recommendations were made with respect to surgical adjuncts for lumbar fusion procedures, such as interbody grafting, as well as pedicle screw stabilization. In 2009, again at the request of the leadership from the AANS-CNS Joint Spine Section, an update was requested for these guidelines given the changes in the literature since the original guidelines were published in 2005. This panel was convened in 2009, and in the upcoming issue of the Journal of Neurosurgery Spine, we will have this update published. Good afternoon, Dan. Thanks for joining us today, and I have a list of questions I'd like to ask you with respect to these guidelines.
Thanks, Mike. It's my pleasure to be here.
So, Dan, why publish guidelines? What is the value of publishing evidence-based guidelines?
There are really three primary values in publishing guidelines. The first is really the self-evident value of capturing what is known or what the state of the literature is about a particular topic. As you know, when you go through the guidelines process, the first thing you do is search the literature, and you're able to, using fairly straightforward methodology, codify the strength of evidence regarding different treatment strategies for different disease processes. And by doing the guidelines process, you identify areas where you have strong evidence to support a treatment practice and areas where you have weak or no evidence to support a treatment practice. So that's probably the most obvious purpose, is to establish a state of the literature, as it were, regarding a particular diagnosis or a particular treatment. The second reason is to establish clinical practice guidelines for use by clinicians. There is so much information out there. There are so many new things happening all the time. It's very difficult for people who are working all the time by practicing medicine to stay current with everything. And these guidelines do a very good job in terms of boiling big questions down to chunks that can be digested and used to guide treatment decisions. We always talk about the three-legged stool of evidence-based medicine, one being the evidence, which is what we codify with the guidelines, the second being patient preferences, and the third being practitioner experience. So it's a very good way to establish one of those three legs in the relationship. The third reason to do it is for advocacy reasons. There's a lot of focus on what are the appropriate uses of lumbar fusion, should lumbar fusion be paid for, and should it be paid for by whom. And right now, the guidelines are probably the most powerful tool we have to provide persuasive arguments to third-party payers and policymakers about the utility of many of the things that we do that work very well for our patients and should be preserved. These procedures should be preserved because we can demonstrate through the guidelines process that there's evidence that these procedures work.
With respect to the original guidelines, which were published in 2005, why an update now? Why is an update necessary at this time?
Well, guidelines need to be updated periodically because life goes on. as the literature changes, you need to update the guidelines to reflect new literature and new findings. If we had published guidelines on the use of leeches for bloodletting in the 1780s and never updated them, we might be still using leeches for bloodletting for tuberculosis, for example.
And with respect to the guideline process, you being very familiar with this, having, as I said before, been part of this process from the get-go, can you give us an idea of what it is to be involved in the guidelines process? And with respect to the current update, have there been any changes made in the methodology compared to the original guidelines in 2005?
As you know, being involved in the guidelines process, it's a labor of love. It's very, very time intensive. It takes a lot of hours, and a lot of the time you take is really paying attention to details, just making sure you don't miss something, making sure you understand what the design of a particular study was, making sure you understand who the patient population was and the outcome measures used. There's a fairly steep learning curve. It takes a couple of years to get up to speed to do this stuff. And one of the nice things that we've done is the guidelines groups have generally been combinations of seasoned folks who have done three or four or five of these plus new faces so that you have a mixture of youthful enthusiasm and, I guess, experienced cynicism around the table at any given time. With this iteration of guidelines, there was a change in the methodology. We went to a five-tiered system from the old three-tiered system. And the real purpose of this is to increase the transparency in terms of the levels of recommendation. One of the limitations of the three-tiered system is that unless you had a randomized controlled study, pretty much everything else ended up being a level three study or a option level recommendation. And the problem with that is it's not always fair because you could have a very well-designed cohort study that simply had a single flaw versus a case series of four patients having the same weight in a three-tiered system. And dividing the system into five tiers, dividing the rating system into five tiers, really, I think, helps with the transparency. And I agree with your decision to do that with this iteration of the guideline.
Who participated this time around with the guideline update?
This time it was a group of neurosurgeons as well as orthopedic surgeons. And we had an administrator help us out with a lot of the library issues and with just organizing the search process and organizing the meetings and helping collate the documents and such. She was very helpful.
And with the topics that were reviewed this time around, were they the same as the first iteration of the guidelines?
Yeah, and that was on purpose. We did add one about economic evaluation, but by and large, we stuck to the same topics.
And if you had to go through those topics this time around, has any one or several demonstrated significant changes from what was previously published?
Well, one thing that was somewhat reassuring is that the conclusions didn't change all that much, although the strength of evidence changed with the paper on stenosis with spondylolisthesis. Thanks to work done by the Dartmouth group and others over the last couple of years ago, we've been able to say with greater certainty what the role for fusion surgery is in that patient population. In the area of bone graft substitutes, there's been an explosion of articles out there regarding the use of bone morphogenetic protein. Being able to incorporate some of those papers allowed us to say more than what we could say in the past. But what I was reassured by is that the basic themes really didn't change. Strength of evidence and some details changed, but overall, I found it reassuring that there weren't wholesale changes in the recommendations based upon 5 years' worth of literature.
With respect to the overall work that's produced by the panel, is there an oversight of this effort from Organization of Neurosurgery?
Now, this is actually an area of confusion, I think, for some of the members of our organizations. The CNS provides administrative support for the formation of guidelines, but the Joint Guidelines Committee, which is a committee of the Washington Committee, which is jointly supported by the NNS and the CNS, is really the oversight committee for organized neurosurgery for all guidelines that are produced by organized neurosurgery, and also provides a review function for outside guidelines if such a function is requested. When this project began, Mark Linsky was the chair of it, and by the time the project ended, Tim Ryken was the chair of that committee. And the guidelines underwent extensive review by the JGC prior to being forwarded to the editorial board of the Journal of Neurological Surgery Spine. And what was, I think, a very good thing is that an arrangement was made that the JGC review, to a large part, functioned as the JNS review. Some of the same people were involved, and I thought the process was handled very well in terms of both the degree of editorial review, the expertise of those doing the review, as well as it being a relatively efficient process.
And I believe the anticipated publication date is upcoming in July of 2014. Once these guidelines are put on the shelf, is there plans for future guidelines endeavors from the joint section?
Well, the section currently has a thoracolumbar trauma guideline in the works. There should be an update for the cervical degenerative disease guideline that was done by Paul Matz a number of years ago. And there's talk of guidelines on MIS, or minimally invasive surgical techniques. I'm not sure exactly what the status of that project is. I should also point out that the section does coordinate with other organizations, such as the North American Spine Society, the Scoliosis Research Society, and others, in doing combined projects in order both to increase the diversity of the writing groups as well as to increase the penetration of the guidelines into the practitioner community.
That's great. Dan, I want to thank you for taking the time to answer some of these questions and giving the constituents some insight into the guideline process.
Great. Thanks, Mike. I enjoyed it.
This concludes our podcast for the July 2014 issue of Journal of Neurosurgery Spine. Thank you for listening.